The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmn.org. Thank you for listening.
This is for Master Wu Men's Gateless Gate, the main case. Master Wu Tzu Fayan said, to give an example, it's like a buffalo passing through a window. Its head, horns, and four legs have all passed through. Why is it that its tail cannot? Woman's commentary. If you can penetrate to the point of this koan, open your Zen eye to it, and give a turning word to it, you will then be able to repay the four obligations above and help the three existences below. If you still cannot do so, work with the tail single-heartedly until you can really grasp it as your own. Poem. If it passes through, it falls into a ditch. If it turns back, it's destroyed. This tiny tail, how extremely marvelous. So, we're here on our last full day of session. On a very, last couple of days have been very autumnal. Today is very autumnal in a different kind of way. Cloudy and cool. I often thought if you just had your eyes closed and just could appear on any given day, could you figure out what season it was just by the smells and the sounds? Wu Tzu Fayan was a teacher in 12th century China, important teacher. He was a teacher of Yuan Wu, who wrote the commentaries and verse and commentaries for the Blue Cliff Record. So Fayan was in the Linji lineage. He was ordained when he was 35, which at that time was kind of old to be ordained, at a time when very often people would ordain quite young. And there's a story where he, one day, he's telling the Sangha. He said, yesterday, I went into town and I noticed a puppet show going on. I couldn't help going over there and taking a look. The puppet was really something to see. At first sight, it seemed to move its limbs, walk around and sit down all on its own. But when you look closer, you could see that there was someone behind the blue curtain. I couldn't help but call out, "Sir, what's your name?" And the puppeteer replied to me, "Honored priest, just watch the show. Why ask for names?" And then Fayan says, "Students, when I heard him say this, I didn't have a single word to say in reply, nor a single idea to espouse. Can any of you say anything in my place? Yesterday, that single instance of embarrassment has uprooted all of my ideas." This is considered a Nanto koan in the history of, you know, every form of practice has its strength, its, you know, sort of particular aspects of power and skillfulness. And within that are also dangers, in a sense, ways that that particular practice might be prone or lead a student to be prone to get lost or entangled in particular ways. The koans, because of their nature, using language and questions and so on, can easily become conceptual. In a sense, they begin as concepts. When a student takes up a koan, there are words and meaning. They have to take that up in their mind and they and work with that in a way to go beyond the words and meaning, which is the power of the koan. One of its sources of power. But in time, there were over history, there were various times where the sort of the koan tradition within the Linji school had its ups and downs. Periods of time where it was very robust and very vibrant, and other times where it became very sort of dead and formulaic. And so Hakuin, Japanese Zen master, fairly late, 1600s, 1700s, helped to sort of revive the koan tradition within Japan, and part of that was to put them into a kind of system. So these different collections that I work from, which were part of the tradition, some of them were within the Linji school. The Book of Serenity came out of the Soto school. He sort of put them into a structure, which is very much pretty similar to how we, our own students, work with them. And one of the things he did was he talked about different kinds of koans that work with students to clarify the nature of mind and self and things in particular ways, through words and meaning, through differentiation. And then he talked about nanto koans, which were koans that were difficult to pass through. And so this is one such koan. And it's interesting, and I only know this from what has been translated, but it's interesting when there are koans that many teachers have commented on. And so you can just see by that particular koan really captured the interest of a lot of different teachers over centuries. And this is one of them. And in a sense, its simplicity is part of what makes it so powerful. And so Fayan says, to give an example, and of course this is all we have, but so we don't know whether this was extracted from a Taisho or what, but in terms of looking at it just as we have it, it's like just walking into the middle of a conversation that in which Fayan seems to assume that we understand the subject. To give an example, it is like a buffalo. What is this it? Well, in a sense, it's not complicated. It's, well, Buddha Dharma speaks of the one great matter, the one essential inquiry, the one practice and realization that frees what is bound. And so he says in the commentary, if you can penetrate the point of this koan, open your eyes to it, you'll be able to repay the four obligations above and help the three existences below. And in that, there's an implication that if you just see this one koan, then everything has been revealed, everything is seen through. And there's a way in which that can be true, but that doesn't mean that it's fully lived. You know, we tend to think that if I just have an insight, an experience, a realization, and see the nature of mind, that's what Kensho means, seeing the nature of the self, then all of my entanglements, all of my attachments, all of my false views will just evaporate. And that I will then live spontaneously in that realization from now on. And that's not, by most accounts, what happens. Because, and I'll talk about this, but those habits are so deep set. And typically the insight is not in one fell swoop seen all the way through. And so we train. And so there are successive koans. There's years of training, whatever our form of practice is. And there's practicing that together, living our lives, encountering things. Repaying the four obligations of one's parents, the sovereign, which would have been prevalent during much of the history of Buddhism, people and all beings, and the three treasures. And in a subtle way, what he's saying is that practice is ultimately for this. It's based in compassion. It is for self and others. It is for all of life. And that we have an obligation to do exactly that, to repay our obligations, to fulfill our responsibility of having received life. What in the Four Reminders is called this precious human birth. And from that teaching, what's understood is what makes it precious is what we do with it. It's not just that it's precious simply because I'm alive. Because ultimately, my life doesn't belong to me, although it is my complete responsibility. But how will I use it? How am I using it? And so in that way, not every life is precious. We can have life, which is sacred and should be respected and valued, but use that most sacred life, vessel, in a way that is does not make this a precious human birth. And so that, again, presents us with that sense of what do I need to do to fulfill that, right? This it, to give an example, it is like a buffalo passing through a window. And when Dada Roshi would give talks on this, he would sort of invoke these little tiny lattice windows, right? This huge, incredible buffalo. You know, I was just thinking, this wasn't actually in my notes, but I was just thinking, Jim and I have been reading, again, this incredible book called Winter Dance by Gary Paulson, who writes children's books and other books, I think. But the story is of how he got into dog racing, sled racing, and then ended up running the Iditarod in Alaska. This is quite a number of years ago. And he's completely insane, this man. He's completely wild. He's like a wild man, which is the only way, I guess, you can do that kind of a thing. And he's a great rider. He's incredibly funny. But he talks about one point in the race where he's, you know, just out in the open space of Alaska, the inner land of Alaska, and he sees a dog team just sitting there, no driver. And he's like, what happened? And, you know, these guys, the people who run this race, they don't sleep, like, at all, for weeks and weeks and weeks. And so it's just unimaginably grueling. And so they have these florid hallucinations. It's just something. Anyway, so he's looking for the driver, and he sees him up on this little knoll laying down on his chest. And he sees Gary and says, come here, come here, come here. And he runs over there, and there's a herd of buffalo and there's a big lake, a frozen lake of ice. And they're climbing up onto this little knoll, and then they go running down. These are the buffalo, one at a time. And when they hit the ice, they splay themselves out and go skidding across the ice and making what must only be a buffalo laugh. And they spin as they... And then they get up and go back and do it again. And he's like, they are playing. They're like having a blast. Can you imagine? Anyway, this buffalo is trying to get through a window. Got much more serious matters at hand. In the commentary, Shibayama says, with this extraordinary question, Master Fayan cuts asunder all possible reasoning on the part of every student in the world. From olden times, this demand, why can't the tail pass through, has been greatly revered as the ultimate power or secret of Fayan's Zen, his teachings. In other words, it is the bleeding cry of compassion trying to eradicate the cause of human ignorance and suffering all at once. Now you tell me, why is it that its tail cannot pass through? And so what he's clearly and obviously saying is that by creating this question, this tension, the whole point of that is to help us free ourselves. It is out of this deep compassion, creating a stir, raising doubt, making waves, it said, where none exist, in order to bring peace to the world. We're studying karma, this Sangha, and it's the burden of our karmic actions that arise from our greed, anger, and delusion, our pride and jealousy, our emotional afflictions that burden us, right? The weight of our regrets and our shame and insecurities, the consequences of our ongoing patterns of our mind and behavior and thinking processes, even our seemingly neutral just daydreaming and distractions, is what dampens and diminishes and overshadows our natural joy and lightness of being and generosity and kindness. You know, we see that from the very beginning of Zazen, we're directly working with these three poisons of greed, anger, delusion. Greed, and when things are rising, acknowledging them, but not grasping. Right? And so we're releasing that reaction, that impulse to grasp our desire, our greed. At the same time, we're not denying, we're not avoiding, we're not suppressing, which is our aversion. And so we're relinquishing both of those extremes of greed and anger. And by keeping the mind clear and bright, we're not falling into confusion and delusion, which takes the form of indifference, dullness, and apathy. So all the head, horns, and legs of the buffalo will pass through. Why will its tail not? In the beginning, we might say that of practice, and for as long as in every moment when they arise, the head and the horns and the big bulk of this body needs to be practiced. All the stuff that presents itself in a big form, hard to miss, not very subtle, those things that we're generally pretty aware of that are creating that weight. Bill Waldron, a scholar, Buddhist scholar, who's a friend of mine in the monastery and has taught here, said about this in the early Buddhist view. It's taught that we're not born with a blank slate, but we come into this life with a set of dispositions called samskaras, habitual tendencies, and the potential to experience the results of our actions that have accumulated over the course of countless past lives in the traditional Buddhist understanding. After consciousness descends into the womb, and this is what we'll be looking at in the last mando next month, rebirth, our sense faculties start to develop conditioned by those pre-existing dispositions. So it's those dispositions that are sort of carried within our consciousness, which is what moves from life to life, from moment to moment. So our sense faculties as a baby start to develop conditioned by those dispositions, so we don't start as a blank slate, as well as the new experiences that give rise to them. So not only are we reacting and responding to things based in those pre-existing dispositions, but the way we respond is creating new dispositions, strengthening the old ones, particularly when we respond in the same way. And those, and he says this entire process repeats itself over and over, building up and reinforcing habitual tendencies that over time become entrenched bodily structures in much the same way that repeated practice of sports or a language or music, a musical instrument, gets etched into our muscle memory and our neural networks. And he says all of this is what Buddhism calls our samskaras, our karmic formations, which is part of the skandhas teaching. It's part of the dependent, the 12-fold chain of causation teaching. It is all formed by this formative process of action and result, reaction, action, result, and so on. He says, in sum, our individual samsaric existence is effectively little more than this mass of accumulated karmic potential, the inertia of our latent dispositions and our constructed behavioral and cognitive patterns. All of this is samskaras. And thus, liberation is defined as the liberation or the illumination of those karmic seeds, those potentialities and dispositions, and the troublesome influences they impart on our actions. And then he says, of course, seeing through these constructions is easier said than done, and for very good reasons. We have evolved to see and to think in terms of essences and entities, in terms of things being entities existing as an object, as a body, objectively, outside of ourself, and having an essence, some inherently existing quality, characteristic, nature, self, soul, that we have evolved to see and experience things in that way. In the perspective of both Buddhism and biology, these are part of our common inheritance as human beings. That's why delusion, in that sense, is universal. Right? It's just a universal human experience that everyone, in a sense, has to become deluded, or perhaps is born deluded, based on those underlying dispositions. We are strongly predisposed to see and feel and think in terms of these essences and entities, and they strongly influence the way we experience our worlds. And so if we think of these big features of the buffalo as these deeply integrated tendencies that become easily activated. And so just think about the importance of Seishin, where, you know, not just for a period, but sustained, period after period, throughout the day, throughout the week, sitting and observing as you develop your concentration and you sit with your mind, and all of these samskaras as they arise, moment by moment, and moments where they don't. And when they arise, and we grasp onto them, or we negate them, they get stronger. And we can see that both in the moment, and we will see that both over time as those tendencies just get more and more habitual. Or something else can happen. When we don't avoid, don't grasp, then they begin to lose their power, because they have no power on their own, because they don't have any existence on their own or any existence at all. But for the accommodation we make for them in our mind and body, in our thoughts, words, and actions, in our beliefs. And so we might think of those underlying dispositions, the samskaras, as something that we want to pull up and extinguish, eradicate. And in fact, sometimes Buddhist teachings use that very language. And so we really have to understand that language is, we have to translate it in our mind so we're not re-reifying and objectifying and making into something which does not, is not that. So we have to understand what is meant by extinguish or eradicate. It really means to realize as empty. Because if we try to extinguish, to eradicate, to get rid of, we cannot. And we'll be frustrated and think something's wrong with me, or something's wrong with the Dharma, or I need another practice, or I need another teacher, or I need another something. Time to move on. But if we try and find any of those things that seem to be the cause of our suffering, can you? Can you locate it? Can you grasp the qualities of that which is arising, that is your struggle? Can you find those characteristics in that emotion, for instance? Shibayama said, this tale is nothing else than the formless form of reality. You may describe it, but in vain. You can picture it, create an image of it, but to no avail. When the world collapses, it is indestructible. It is unborn and undying. How could it be eradicated? Dogen said of this tale, this world is but the tale of a buffalo passing through a window. We could reflect on that for a while. This world is but the tale of a buffalo passing through a window. The tale is your mind, which knows neither passing nor not passing. The tail is not bound, but it is not free. It is not you, but it is not not you. The question Fion is asking is, why won't it pass through? Everything else has passed through. How do we free ourselves? What does that mean? From within Buddha's understanding, and then what is the reality of that? As we sit here so earnestly seeking to free ourselves and to free others, it would be good to have a good understanding of that. In the book Karma that we're studying, Trailuk Kyabgan says, cause and effect are seen as mutually dependent on each other. They don't exist apart. Agents and their actions are regarded as mutually dependent as well. What you do and the person doing are mutually dependent. One doesn't exist without the other. This is how we should begin to understand karma. That everything arises in a relationship of mutual dependency, co-arising. He says, to see it any other way would be diverge from Buddha's middle view, the middle path. To say karma doesn't exist at all, that it's completely illusory, it's empty, doesn't exist, would be one extreme. Or to think that it actually exists, that karmic causes and effects have a true reality, a consequence that is something in and of itself, that would be the other extreme. Nagarjuna said, karma doesn't have true reality because it's empty of inherent existence, but it does manifest. There is impact, there's consequence, there is suffering. It is a manifest phenomenon. To that extent, it is real, it exists. To say that the tail doesn't obstruct denies the reality of our struggles. To say the tail does obstruct gives it a false power. This is the importance of this teaching of non-duality, of leaping free of these extremes. It's the profound nature of the Buddha's realization of the middle way. Because our overwhelming tendency, the easiest thing for us to do is to go to one side or the other. And if we just observe our own particular lives, the lives around us, the world at large, isn't that what we see on display everywhere? And of course, once you have chosen a side, you're on that side. And now you are facing those on the other side. And there's a problem. Hakuin says about this koan, Master Fion likes the tail that won't pass through. As for me, I like the tail that can pass through. Troublemaker. Do they contradict each other? Isn't it beautiful to think of these teachers speaking to each other right across these centuries, like having these intimate conversations and understanding each other? Attaching to words and meaning, we will choose a side. The question only is, which side are you on? Each side constructs a world, a way, a view, a right, a wrong. If we deny the pain in our hearts or in someone else's heart, then we can never really skillfully face and examine and pass through, free ourselves of that pain. If we believe that that pain has a fixed or independent nature, it just is, then we can never ultimately be free of it. Then trying to avoid it at all costs actually makes a lot of sense. Or suppressing it, or blaming somebody else for it. All of those strategies that we all know too well make sense then, right? They're logical responses. The fact that they don't work shows us that they're based on a false view. And so while there are ultimately no sides, boundaries can be established. For a bodhisattva, that is done when it's skillful to establish a boundary. In practice, sometimes we have to establish a sense of something, a sense of self, a sense of identity. When that has not fully come into our possession, you might say, when we are not fully and sort of with a reasonable sense of well-being, holding that, occupying that, because it has not been allowed, it has been denied of a person. We can think of that in terms of emotions, anger. If anger has never been allowed or been, you know, a person has been punished every time they've been angry, then you learn pretty quickly, don't get angry. And so then in practice, in order to free ourselves of that anger, right, which quite logically we would have then put far away, we have to allow that anger to be, because it is already. And so by when we allow it to rise, we're not actually, in a real sense, creating more anger. We're just now acknowledging what's there. Now we can practice it. It's like in the Beyond Fear work, when we eventually began to recognize the importance of working in affinity groups. And the criticism was, and continues to be from some folks, how can we do that as Buddhists? How can we create these divisions and create these boundaries? Aren't we trying to dissolve all those boundaries? Yes. But those boundaries, because of our racialized history, already exist. They're already functioning. We're already steeped in them and entrenched in them and acting out of them. And so by establishing those groups, we allow that those identities to be seen and recognized in a way that's skillful, so that ultimately, yes, we move forward towards being one unified Sangha, in fact, in body and mind. I was thinking of John Powell, who Chika introduced me to years ago, and he was giving a talk, and somebody said, and he was saying that, you know, oftentimes white folks say, why are you always talking about race? And he said, look, I am happy to stop talking about race when you start talking about it. That really stayed with me. That idea that by talking about something, we are generating more of it. And of course, that can happen. That can take place. What's the difference in what we're talking about here? Intention, mindfulness, understanding, a path, understanding karma, having a reasonably good sense of what it is we're doing and why. The middle way is a kind of radical abstaining from creating and destroying as being a model for life. Think about that. How much energy do we put into, you know, how much do we purported, or do we seem to delight in life, but how much energy we put into destroying it? A radical dissolution of every boundary and divide without denying that boundaries actually exist. But in a way, because you have Buddha nature, which is boundless, has no division, the middle way isn't radical at all. It's the most natural, original, uncontrived, essential thing when we begin to consider it, speaking from my own bias as a Buddhist. Why won't this tail pass through? Its heads, horns, four legs have all passed through. In the poem, woman says, if it passes through, it falls into a ditch. But isn't passing through the point? Why does he say it falls into a ditch? If it turns back, it's destroyed. Dogen said, to advance the self to realize the 10,000 things is delusion. And yet, if we don't step forward, he also said, we can never encounter the Dharma. How do we step forward? How to be free of denial and clinging? The teachings say to abandon all hope and expectation. What happens when you abandon all hope? When you abandon all expectation? Just think about it. In one period of sitting, in one session, empty yourself of any sense of hope or expectation about this session. Where are you now? Fully occupying the seat. The next moment comes as it will. And you are unencumbered to meet it. It passes as it will. And there's no remorse. And so we practice ongo, practicing peaceful dwelling, we practice sesshin, we practice daily. Taking up this head, horns, and four legs, but this tiny tail, the smallest part, for goodness sake. This buffalo thought it was home free, right? Done all the hard work. This tiny tail. Why does woman say this tiny tail, how extremely marvelous? We just want to be done with that damn tail, right? I remember in the early years, you know, when Dada Roshi would talk about the endlessness of the path and it has no end, and I would think, oh, I know that's supposed to be a good thing. Why doesn't it not feel like a good thing right now? I could see the end, then I could buck up and just... But it's endless. And he would say that with delight. And I would think, okay, here I am. I see what I'm seeing. What are you seeing? This tiny tail. How is it that the very thing and things that we think are the source of our suffering, are the doorways, are not suffering? In the Diamond Sutra, Yoshi was talking about yesterday, the Buddha said, in alleviating suffering, not a single being has been liberated. In practicing non-attachment, not a single thing has been let go. And yet we practice our non-attachment and we vow to liberate all beings of suffering. That's why the four great vows are important. And important as they are expressed, that get under your skin and hopefully trouble you. What do you mean sentient beings are numberless and I vow to save them? How can I do that if they're numberless? Exactly. How can I get this tail through the window if everything else much, much larger has passed through? You know, one way of, it's not really the point of the koan, but one way of looking at this is these underlying dispositions. The Buddha said that there are those samskaras, those aspects of our conditioned underlying dispositions that we practice and that dissolve, right? That no longer haunt us, that no longer are really a force in our life. But that there are other subtle aspects that continue, even as a person is developing and becoming quite clear and mature as a Buddhist practitioner. He said the most long-lasting, sort of tenacious clinging is simply to the sense of self. That sense, I am. And as Bill says, it makes sense that we see things in terms of entities and essences, in terms of I am, because here I am. I'm talking. You're listening. Right? Seems pretty clear. But we go further. That's the thing. We always go further and add meaning. What does it mean? Or we don't go far enough and examine the real thing. Master Dogen said in one of his fascicles, quoting Zhui Fang, the entire great earth is a gate of emancipation. Even if I invite people, they will not get through. Know that the entire great earth is a gate of emancipation. Going in and out of it is not easy. There are not many who go in and out. You know, this will never be, not in this way, even though Buddhism, you know, is one of the great world religions and there are millions and millions of people who are Buddhists, and there are many different ways of practicing Buddhism. This particular way of practicing, putting your butt on this cushion, not turning away, moment after moment, day after day, month after month, year after year, decade after decade, a lifetime of practice, that is never going to be a mass movement. Probably. Although, you know, sometimes we surprise ourselves as humanity. Going in and out is not easy. There are many who do not go in and out. Some, even if they are invited, will not go in and out. Those who step forward may miss it. Those who step backward will stand still. How? If you try to have others go in and out, it moves further away. What is compassion? If you try to make somebody else go in and out of this gate, it moves further away. If you have a gate which accepts others, then it is possible for everyone to go in and out. If you have a gate which accepts others, every other, then it is utterly possible to go in and out. This gate, this tiny tail, how extremely marvelous is the great heart of Canon. In this, no one, no thing is forsaken. And you cannot buy it, you cannot sell it, you cannot corrupt it. Thank goodness. Even that is a folly. A student once asked Master Zhui Fang, how is it when solitary and independent? When solitary and standing alone? Zhui Fang said, still sick. Still sick. Yes, to arrive at this place of solitary and alone, but to not stop there. Yes, to pass the head, horns, and legs through the window, and then about this tail. Why will it not pass through? And as Shibayama says, it's this why that is so important.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.